visitors there in Ronkonkoma report for the US2N, K2IW the Technet.
Yeah, mine's working okay. But I did have an old one years ago and started to leak. And it was the test for that is you take a piece of paper, you know, and you put it between the gasket and the metal when it closes. And if you just put it in what area you think is leaking, and if you can pull that out, you have a problem. And then you don't have to go looking for other problems inside the unit and think something else is wrong. You know, you'll put it into the area that where it's tight, and when you pull that piece of paper, it won't come out. But then you go to a loose area, and you'll notice it'll come right out. And that'll be a good test after you've gone through the heat gun system, like Barry mentioned. After you're done, you take a piece of paper, put it in between the two, and pull it, see if it comes out now. See if it's sick. Back to you, Dick.
Another very good suggestion, Paul. Now, I forget what subject you wanted to go further in space report if we had the time. I think it was you. I'm going to guess it's the probability of putting men on Mars, putting men in orbit around Mars, putting men on the moon, even putting men on the moon for a real length of time, more than 2 days, let's say. It's a big deal. Because that moon, with its 28-day period, it's at high noon for 12 days, and it's at midnight for 12 days, so to speak. It goes up to ridiculously high temperatures at high noon, and ridiculously cold temperatures at nighttime. So unless you've got the world's best air-conditioned and insulated habitat, let me drop this. And even if your habitat had the world's best insulation and the world's best air conditioning, no matter how good your insulation is, that only tells you the leak down rate. If the temperature outside at high noon on the moon is 150 degrees Kelvin, which is around close to 300 degrees Fahrenheit, it's almost an oven temperature. And so that oven temperature, no matter how good your habitat insulation is, it's only going to take some number of hours to penetrate inside and cook the inhabitants. So therefore, if your air conditioning fails, you've got to have some damn good way of bailing out, if you know what I mean. So putting a habitat on the surface of the moon, I think, is a very big problem. If you can put it 50 meters below the surface where the temperature is almost constant, yes. But that takes you some number of weeks of digging in order to establish that. Where are those people going to live during that digging procedure? So putting a colony on the moon, because the moon is so close, it sounds easy. You get into the details. It's very life-threatening, very difficult if you're going to put people there for more than, let's say, 3 days. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, well, one theory is that they want to do it with robots. You know, you have all this equipment on the moon, and you have people in orbit around the moon, and maybe even positioned in one location at the moon. You can do that, I think, at 40,000 miles out, which is, you know, it's pretty far, but they plan on eventually doing that. And they could pretty much stay in one place. And they could operate, you know, robots real time, you know, without the 2 second delay from Earth. And assemble either dig down into the moon or put habitats together. It's a long way off. First thing you're going to see is launches probably within a couple of years of companies that are trying to win the $20 million from Google. They have the Google Prize, and they'll be landing unmanned robots onto the onto the moon. And the deal is, after it lands, you have to be able to send back high-definition TV. We drop it. And then move 500 meters somehow, either on wheels or take off again and go 500 meters down the road a piece, and then send back more HD TV, and then you're going to win $20 million. There's about 20 companies that fight to do this, and I think there's about 3 or 4 that will probably be competing. I know Japan has one that's, you know, they're ready to go. All they need is some kind of a launch vehicle that's going to get them there. And we have an American guy, Moon Express, I think is the name of it. I'll have to check that. But he's ready to go. We'll see. That'll be your first flight, probably within a couple of years. The one thing I wanted to mention was in about a month or so from now, we're going to be able to probably watch again from Long Island a launch of an Antares rocket going out of Wallops Island, Virginia. And the reason I know that is just last week, Orbital ATK, the builder of the rocket and also the builder of the Cygnus Supplier spacecraft that sends, you know, up to almost 10,000 pounds of stuff to the space station. They'll be making their own flight again probably this July, and that should be very interesting. They've launched a couple of Cygnus spacecraft in the last 6 months by the Atlas V rocket. They hitched a ride. They paid United Launch Alliance to do that in Florida. This is why the Antares is being rebuilt, you know, back in 2014, October. They had the launch of the old Antares rocket that blew up, and they blamed it on the Russian NK-33 engines that were remodified for reuse. And it didn't work out too good. Blew up the pad and blew up the spacecraft. Let me drop it. So, make a long story short, once this thing gets back into operation, just like we've been able to see in the past, well on the horizon, you should be able to, you know, if you have a good view to the southwest, be able to see something go up. I know I did. And even some of the guys I know from Connecticut saw it from the coastline. But it's pretty cool. That'll be launched to the International Space Station in July. They have one up there now, docked with the space station, and that should come deorbit within a couple of weeks. And they're not going to just deorbit it right away. It's going to fill up with garbage, but it has experiment on board. They want to experiment with what fires do inside of a spacecraft when it's almost uncontrolled. And robotically, they're going to ignite this thing, you know, before it deorbits. And they'll take pictures, and they got 100 different instruments on board, and it's going to transmit all kinds of information to try to eventually create safer flying spacecraft, you know, in case of fire, and that'll deorbit within the, I guess before the end of the month. That's a Cygnus spacecraft that's been attached for probably 3 months up till early April, I guess. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2M.
WS2M, KQRIW. So we're going to be able to see another launch from Wallops Island. In the case of using a robot to land on the moon, take photographs and mail them back home, high-resolution photographs, I think you said move 500 meters, and do it again. And I guess you're saying this is the Google Prize, some number. number of $1 million offered by Google to do this. I guess it's the modern day equivalent of the so-called Ansari Prize, but I think that was the name of the prize where the first man-powered aircraft that would fly 1 mile figure-eight course. Then there was another one for a man-powered aircraft that would fly across the English Channel. And then another one for a man-powered, for a solar-powered aircraft that would fly across the English Channel. And I think AeroViron company, Paul McGreedy was his, maybe that's his name, or was that the name of his chief aerodynamicist? They won all three prizes, as I remember. So how long ago did Google offer this multi-million dollar prize, I think he said? And I guess their motivation is to move in the direction of colonizing the moon. Is that the idea, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, to eventually have a private company be able to do that. You know, that was set up, oh, I don't know, probably 5, 6, 7 years ago. And they have to do it. They have to have a scheduled launch, I think, by the end of 2017. So they're kind of running out of time. You know, they Google put a date on it. And the last one I remember was, I forgot how many millions. Well, this one's $20 million. But the last one was, I think that was the Ansari Prize. That was won by Virgin, I'm trying to think of what they were calling it. Yeah, I think that was Virgin Galactic because, you know, by the time it was turned over to them. But it was Scale Composites. They're the ones that built it. You know, Paul Rattan, he's the same guy that built Voyager, that sent Voyager on a flight around the Earth without landing. Well, that guy, he built a company called Scale Composites, and he built Spaceship One. And then eventually Virgin Galactic got a hold of that. And now he's building Spaceship Two. Spaceship One held one person from driving. And the prize was, I forgot for how many millions of dollars, but the prize was to, I think it was $10 million. I'll have to look it up. But the prize was to launch a person into space, you know, the common line that's 100 kilometers up. And then come back, and then within 2 weeks, launch that same spacecraft up again. And they did that. They actually did with another pilot. And they succeeded in doing that in 2004. So that was the last big prize that I remember. The other ones that you were talking about were, you know, early day flights. But now they have the Google prize, $20 million for landing on the moon and then sending back HDTV and then somehow get the vehicle 500 meters away from where you landed and do the same thing over again. Some of these companies, I think it's Moon Express, pretty sure that's the name of it, a guy named, maybe you can put it in, I'll think of it, and he's closest to doing it. I think he's probably going to win. He's going to hitch a ride on, originally I thought it was going to be a Falcon 9, but he's got a contract signed with another company called Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab is another new company that's coming up, and he operates out of the United States, but he's not going to launch out of the United States. He's going to launch out of the North Island of New Zealand, and he's got his launch facility already built. He started building it on the South Island, but then they chased him out of there, too populated, I guess, and then he went further north, and on the North Island of New Zealand. So, he's doing pretty good, this guy. I'm waiting for his first launch, though. But he's got a lot of money, and he's got plans on having reusability as well. He's got a pump. His turbo pumps aren't even going to cannot be operated like everybody else's turbopump pumps. He's going to run them on electricity. They call it the electron rocket. The electric rocket, I think they call it. Instead of running these pumps, you know, they usually run 1,000 RPM, almost 100,000 RPM. He's going to run them with electric motors. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Paul, the $20 million Google Prize on this moon project, first of all, what's it called? But the main thing I really want to know is how long ago was that prize announced? And I think you're saying the launch has got to be before the end of 2017. So they put a real deadline on it. How long ago was that prize announced? And you probably told us about it, but I have forgotten about this one. Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, well, the Google Prize, and in fact, the first time I heard it was on this net. Believe it or not, I like being on this net because my goal is to learn things. And I think John, KC2WGV, brought up the Google Prize, and it had to be, I don't know, 6 years ago. I'm going to pick the number out of a hat. I'm going to say it had to be 2010 or 2009 or something when I first heard about this Google Prize, and then I naturally researched it. Yeah, I found out it's a $20 million prize. I don't know. You could ask John if he remembers it. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, John, are you the guy that brought that to our attention? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet. Maybe he got called away. Now, when it comes to using robots to do the excavation of the moon in order to make a permanent habitat below the surface, I'm convinced that the permanent habitat's got to be below the surface. Other than that, no matter how good your insulation is, when you've got 12 solid days of high noon approaching 300 degrees Fahrenheit, there is no insulation in the world that's going to keep your habitat from becoming an oven without damn good air conditioning. And if that air conditioning fails, it's game over. So you got to build a habitat below the surface. To do that by robots, and to control those robots from the Earth by way of good cameras, except for the 2.5 second time delay round trip, that's very doable. To put astronauts in orbit to do the commanding and observation, let me drop them. The good news of astronauts in orbit is now with their high-speed camera and their telescopes on board, they can see the excavation going on. But the proper kinds of cameras on the robots could do that for you. To put astronauts in orbit, because they're using consumables, you can only keep them there for a certain number of days. Whereas if you're controlling this from the Earth, if it takes a couple of months or a couple of years, it doesn't matter. So I think you want to control it from the Earth, having real good cameras showing you what's going on. Multiple robots doing the work. That's the right way to do it. Maybe a little bit of orbital astronauts doing some critical part of the operation, but not the majority of the operation. Maintaining a man in space is damn difficult. I mean, the Progress ship is shipping, 5,000 pounds of hardware up to the International Space Station every month or so of consumables, because that's what they're consuming. Human beings consume a lot of stuff to keep them alive. And on the Earth, all that stuff gets recycled, and we forget about it. In space, the majority of it doesn't get recycled. You have to supply a lot of raw materials continuously. Air, water, food, heating, cooling, energy, all kinds of stuff. So, if the Google Prize, 500 meters, let me drop it.
WGB is back.
Now, was it you that brought to our attention some number of years ago the so-called Google Prize, $20 million for doing this operation on the moon? Was it you that brought that to our attention, John? KC2WGB, K2IW. Paul says it wasn't him.
Yes, it was, and it was on the TechNet. Paul's absolutely right. Yeah, because I was wondering about it, and being that I was that he was doing research on the space program and stuff, I thought I'd question, and he said he was going to look into it, which he did. And I was inside the lab with the HD. I could hear you, but I couldn't get back to you quick enough. So yeah, I'm guilty of that.
I do that too. When Paul starts his speech on the space net, I use that to take a break, to go get a drink or whatever. And once in a while, I don't get back in time. I'm with a handy talking, so I can hear what's going on. I do the same thing. Sometimes I make a pit stop. So I presume the whole purpose of the Google Prize is to move in the direction of colonizing the moon. If you can put a robot on the moon, do some kind of an operation, take photographs, move it 500 meters, do some other kind of operation, take photographs. You're moving in the direction of putting robots on the moon that can modify the moon in the direction of establishing a habitat. And I'm convinced that some portion of the habitat, I believe, has to be below the surface. Because as we heard me say, no matter what habitat you put on the surface, no matter how good the insulation is, when the outside temperature is nearly 300 degrees Fahrenheit, that only tells you the rate at which the habitat is going to be heating up. And without air conditioning, it ain't going to stay habitable. You're going to cook human beings. And cooking human beings is not the right thing to do. So, how much of the motivation of this $20 million prize was described? Was it described as the first few steps of colonizing the moon, John? KC2WGB, A2LIW.
Dick, I don't remember the particulars. I just can't recall what the prize was actually for. They had to reach a certain point. But, you know, I agree with you, Dick. I think going to the moon, it's difficult, but it's doable with our technology we have today. It can be done. Going to Mars, if they're saying within 20 years, Dick, I am positive they're going to be sending corpses there.
What gets there might not be a corpse, but you're not going to get a living human being back home. The year of exposure in space, you don't have the protection of our magnetic field and our atmosphere. The magnetic field takes all those charged particles coming out of the sun, the solar wind, and deflects them. And the ones that get through the magnetic field, the atmosphere absorbs those. You get above that atmosphere and above that magnetic field, and above that protection, you're being hit by all of those million mile an hour solar wind particles, all of those cosmic rays, all of those gamma ray bursts. There's all kinds of things going on in space. Once every few years, the sun does a burp of billions and billions of pounds of stuff that shoots toward the Earth at some ridiculous velocity. This is all life-threatening stuff. The chances of spending a year in a fraction getting human beings to Mars, putting them on the surface of Mars, we drop them. And Mars is not a hell of a lot better than being in space because it has essentially no atmosphere. I did do a little research over the week and I found out the atmospheric pressure on Mars is equivalent roughly to the atmospheric pressure on the Earth at 120,000 feet. Well, at 120,000 feet, you put a human being there and his blood boils very rapidly. He dies very fast. So that's essentially no atmosphere. It's got no magnetic field, essentially no atmosphere, no protection from solar wind particles, no protection from cosmic rays, and so solar outbursts. You really don't want a human being there. It's cold as all hell. High in vacuum is all hell. Barren is all hell. It's the world's worst desert. Other than certain kinds of research you can do with a robot, you don't want a human being there. It sounds attractive. It sounds like, let me drop it. If you want to be super optimistic, you can say that roughly 5 billion years from now, at the end of the life of the sun, when it starts becoming a red giant, and it starts burning. orbiting of the Earth. If you go to the next planet out, Mars, you'll be all right for a while. We'll need some other place to go in 5 billion years. And so to move toward Mars sounds like it's in the right direction. But wow. So, the moon, colonizing the moon, there's certain advantages of doing that. And by the time you iron out all the problems of colonizing the moon, you've solved 3/4 of the problems of going to Mars. So the moon makes a lot more sense. And on the moon, you can set up some very good optical and radio telescopes. You can do a lot of research. Let me drop it. Because the moon has essentially no atmosphere, water flow, and whatever destroying the geology, you can easily look back as to what the Earth and Moon were like 4 billion years ago. Whereas you try to do that kind of research on the Earth, the continuous weathering and geology changes are burying all of your evidence. You don't have that problem on the Moon. So you can find out a lot about what early astronomy was like billions of years ago by investigating the Moon. So there's a few reasons for going there. Expensive, life-threatening, but roughly 1,000 times easier than going to Mars.
Good question, Dick.
Go ahead with your question, John.
Dick, if we were to place, say, like a SETI project on the Moon, the noise level here on Earth is quite high. What would be the benefit in noise reduction, and do you think that would be something... I mean, they could monitor the results from Earth, but the station should be on the move, on the Moon. Do you think that would be a big benefit to them? Back to you, Dick.
There's a yes and a no to that. If you go to the right website, which I'll eventually mail to you guys, which I found in the last week, with the ALMA project, A-L-M-A, at the European Southern Observatory in Chile, on the top of the mountain. This is a massive millimeter wave telescope, and it's giving you an extremely high resolution picture of a galaxy that has a black hole in the center of it. It's giving you a picture, they give you the two pictures side by side, the Hubble picture of this galaxy and the ALMA picture done by millimeter wave astronomy. This millimeter wave telescope, I think it fills up a square mile of a whole bunch of dishes, 65 dishes or something like that, 80 feet diameter over the square mile. I don't know the exact numbers. It's a great big phased array, which gives you a very high resolution picture. To do that on the Earth requires a lot of money and a lot of resources. To take all of that hardware and transport it to the Moon, they've got millions of pounds of hardware in that ALMA square mile millimeter wave radio telescope. Let me drop it. Yes, the Moon is quieter, but it's not that much quieter. It's 250,000 miles away, and each pound of stuff you ship to the Moon, if it takes you $1,000 to put a pound of stuff in orbit, how many dollars does it take to put a pound of stuff on the surface of the Moon? Paul can probably tell us that. Guarantee it's a lot of money. So, colonizing the Moon is a way of putting man into space. Is it really the right place to put up a typical, very large optical or radio telescope? Yes, it's quieter, particularly if you go on the backside of the Moon, on the backside from the Earth. It's quieter. That's of limited advantage, because although you've got a lot of man-made noise of electronic equipment down here on the Earth, let me drop it. You choose a really quiet spot, like that hole in the ground at Arecibo, Puerto Rico, or that very quiet spot in Green Bank, West Virginia, where the National Radio Astronomy Observatory is located, or on top of that mountain in the Paranel, Chile. You can find quiet spots on the Earth. And if you need quieter than that, you use the right kind of filtering and the right kind of time domain. And when you're in one of those quiet spots, the bursts of noise you get that are man-made are finite in length, predictable in amplitude, and you can gate them out, if you know what I mean. that you're going to get a spike of noise from man-made stuff for a millisecond, once every second. But you and I could build the right kind of a gating function for the receiver to gate out that noise. And you can filter it. You can do spatial filtering, frequency filtering, time domain filtering. So the quieter advantage is of limited advantage on the moon. That's not enough to make the huge investment of putting millions of pounds of radio telescope there, in my opinion. Let me drop. So your next question is, why go to the moon? It's a way to get the bugs out of the system to put man into space. Would you really want to inhabit the moon? I mean, as a vacation spot, what does it offer? Extremely beautiful, dark picture of the sky. Not a single cloud. So when it comes to optical astronomy, yeah, you've got a view of the sky. There's an advantage. In the case of an optical telescope, you rarely build an optical telescope more than 8 meters, 10 meters, 20 meters in diameter. And now you want to put it in a spot that's got very little atmospheric attenuation, atmospheric distortion. So an optical telescope on the moon, huge advantage. Radio telescope, I'm not so sure. But getting the bugs out of putting man in space, that's an advantage. Still going to take a lot of bucks to finance it. The Apollo program cost $33 billion in 1970 money. To put the exact same Apollo, to do the exact same Apollo mission again today, after the current inflation rate, I don't think you could do it for $150 billion. That's a lot of bucks. Over here, John. Take your eyes off. You willing to finance that, John?
Sure. You're a bag of shells. Get the bag, Martin. Yeah, well, I agree with the moon. I think it's a way to test a lot of equipment that we're building. Any instrumentation we put there, whether it be optical or radio telescopes, we really don't have to be there. We could handle the signals from Earth, and maybe we'll find a way of doing it piece by piece. I think that would be an advantage in the long run. But as far as Mars, I agree with you. A few years ago I said 50 years, so maybe it's now like 45 years. But I think even then it's going to be a very dangerous mission and very expensive. And who is going to pay for that one? That's going to be a worldwide... It's got to be a consortium of the world to do that. I don't think we could do that ourselves. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
I agree with you. I'm hearing NY2H on the input, but you're not coming through the machine. Either you don't have the PL turned on, or you're not strong enough for the machine to NY2H, K2RIW.
You're right, I didn't have the PL on. Can we get back to the expansion of the universe for a few minutes?
It's a darn good subject. Go right ahead, Luke.
Okay, so NASA had come out with this. It's on the NASA website about the expansion of the universe. Now they're saying it's 5% to 9% faster than expected. They did use the Hubble, and they looked at 1A supernovae, but they also did look at Cepheids. I think Eric and you kind of dismissed the Cepheid aspect of it, so you may want to check this out. They measured 2,400 Cepheid stars in 19 galaxies, and I think they kind of used them as calibrators to get approximation down with the thing is 2.4% now of accuracy. So the ramifications are that Einstein's theory of gravity is definitely incomplete, and there's a whole article on it. Maybe you want to look at that. I wasn't sure that I got the point across before. Back to you.
Now it's possible, Lou, that the Cepheids are used for nearby measurements, and the Super 1A supernovas are used for the flower measurements. The 1 a.m. supernovas, I know, are a lot brighter. So the longer distance, you need the brightest thing you can get. That's a standard candle. The separate variables, I don't think, are bright enough to be measured at a 13 billion light year distance. I think you can just barely measure those with the 1A supernovas. That's a guess on my part. Yes, you've got to measure the near stuff and the far stuff to find out what's the differential in the velocities. So I think you're saying now the current reading is the far out stuff is moving 3 or 5% faster in acceleration than it was before. And right now, I don't know if either you or I know what is that rate of acceleration out there that supposedly is being caused by dark energy. Over to you, Lou, KQRIW.
Yeah, so the Cepheids, they were out about 100 million light years away, maybe a little more than that. So they measured the Cepheid luminosity, I guess, and also 1A supernovae in those same galaxies. Then they went out, you know, to the edges, and of course it was just the supernovae that they could look at. So I think what they did is some kind of calibration with this technique, which brought them where their accuracy, gave them a gain in accuracy. They're saying that the improved Hubble constant value is now 45.5 miles per second to megaparsec. And it says a megaparsec equals 3.26 million light years.
So the refined Hubble constant. However, you've got a Hubble constant for the stuff that's nearby and a Hubble constant for the stuff that's far out. You've got a sliding Hubble constant. So what's the minimum and maximum Hubble constant? I wonder if that was made. Was that made clear? Lou, go ahead.
Well, let me look through the article. It does say that the mean distance between cosmic objects now will double in another 9.8 billion years. I don't know what the previous estimate was. Just to give you some words here, the refined calibration presents a puzzle because it does not quite match the expansion rate predicted for the universe from its trajectory seen shortly after the Big Bang. Measurements of the afterglow from the Big Bang by the Wilkinson Microwave Astronomy Probe and the European Space Agency's Planck satellite mission yield predictions which are 5% and 9% smaller for the Hubble constant, respectively. Let me let it drop. It says if we know the initial amounts of stuff in the universe, such as dark energy and dark matter, and we have the physics correct, then you can go from a measurement at the time shortly after the Big Bang and use that understanding to predict how fast the universe should be expanding today. And this is from Adam Riess, I guess. He's a Nobel laureate. He's with Johns Hopkins and I guess with NASA. However, if the discrepancy holds up, it appears we may not have the right understanding, and it changes how big the Hubble constant should be today. You know, there's more to the article, so if anybody's interested, if you go on the NASA site and just Google, I guess, expansion of the universe, it's going to be published. It's not published yet in the Astrophysics Journal. So it's relatively new news. That's why I said it came out just this week. So you guys were talking about the 1As. I think you're just going back to older knowledge, and I wanted you to understand that this is something new.
Yeah, when it comes to measuring celestial distances, you've got to use a so-called ladder approach. The really nearby stuff that you measure in parsecs, you do that by triangulation. The Earth, in a 6 month period of time, you go from one end of our orbit around the sun to the other end, and that's a standard distance, and you measure by triangulation to a particular nearby star, and you measure megaparsecs.
Give you some of the words on that.
Yeah, then you measure parsecs. And then that becomes a standard kind of a measuring stick that you use for the next step, which I think is the separate variables. But give some more words on this. periodically. And the origin of this 5% correction, was that done by Johns Hopkins? Over to you, Lou, KTRIW.
Okay, first of all, yeah, they talk about the laddered approach. Three steps. Expansion rate, unprecedented accuracy, 2.4%. Astronomers made the measurements by streamlining and strengthening the construction of the cosmic distance ladder, which is used to measure accurate distances to galaxies near and far from Earth. They have an illustration, and on the left it says, astronomers use Hubble to measure the distances to a class of pulsating stars called Cepheid variables, employing a basic tool of geometry called parallax. Same technique that surveyors use to measure distances on Earth. Once they calibrate the surface's true brightness, they can use them as cosmic yardsticks to measure distances to galaxies much further away than they can with the parallax technique. Let me drop. Now, the rate at which the Cepheids pulsate provides an additional fine-tuning to the true brightness, with slower pulses for brighter Cepheids. The astronomers compare the calibrated true brightness values with the star's apparent brightness, as seen from Earth, to determine accurate distances. So, and it goes on and on, too much to read here on the air, but yeah, so they get into that whole laddered approach. And I'll tell you about the fellow in a second. I got to go back to another page. Hold on. Okay, so he's Nobel laureate Adam Reitz of the Space Telescope Science Institute and Johns Hopkins University, both in Baltimore, Maryland.
From your reading of that article, where they've now made refinements of distances and rates of acceleration and deceleration, it's actually rate of deceleration, rate of acceleration out of the outer stuff. I vaguely remember that roughly 5 billion light years is the dividing line between the inner stuff is slowing down, the outer stuff is speeding up, and somewhere around 5 billion light years of radius from us is where the rate of acceleration or deceleration is essentially zero. Is that roughly what they say nowadays, Lou? NY2H, K2LIW?
Yeah, I don't see anything referring to that. I personally don't know. But again, the point is they're saying the speedier universe may be telling astronomers that Einstein's theory of gravity is incomplete. We know so little about the dark parts of the universe, it's important to measure how they push and pull on space over cosmic history. And this is another fellow, Texas A&M, saying that. They use the Hubble Sharp-Eyed Wide Field Camera 3. The team they use is called the SHOES team, Supernova HO for the Equation of State team, which works to refine the accuracy of the Hubble constant to precision that allows for a better understanding of the universe's behavior. They're striving to reach an accuracy of 1%. Future telescopes such as James Webb, the Infrared Observatory, Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope could also help.
Now, one possible explanation that I've used, I could easily be wrong, is a subset of what's called Newton's conundrum. Newton pretty much figured out the gravitational law, inverse square law of gravity. Mass 1, mass 2, gravity constant divided by range squared tells you the amount of force you're going to get between two objects of known amount of mass, gravitational attraction. And so when you're putting something in orbit around the Earth, you can consider the Earth a central force motion point source of gravity. If you calculated all of the mass of the Earth and you put it at one dot in the center of the Earth and you calculated the orbit, you come up with essentially the right answer, except for the slight perturbation to get mass concentration. That's why they call it central force motion. So when it comes to the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, you can assume the Sun has all of its mass at one dot in the center of the Sun. We dropped. not at one dot in the center, but if it was one thin shell of material out at the perimeter of the Earth, if all the mass of the Earth is one thin shell, walking on the Earth, you would sense no difference. Putting something in orbit, you would sense no difference. But if you walked inside that shell, no matter where you are inside the shell, you would experience zero gravity, because the amount of material above you and below you, to the left of you, to the right of you, is always equal, and it follows the inverse square law too. So that whether you're in the center or 25% off the way of center, you'll measure zero gravity. You'll be in a microgravity environment. If you have a uniform thin shell of mass at the perimeter of the Earth, drop. Now, what do you sense if that shell of material is lumpy? Now, inside the Earth, you will sense gravity. As you come close to one of those lumps, you'll sense local gravity. Therefore, assume we have a multiverse, multiple universes out there. There's a hell of a lot of material in existence way beyond our observable horizon. But the material out there is lumpy. It's not all in one spot. Although you're seeing very minor variations with the Kobe, WMAP, and Planck pictures, you still are seeing a degree of lumpiness. Therefore, the outer material at the perimeter of what you and I can observe could be accelerated toward those lumps. The thing I'm having a lot of trouble with believing is that dark energy is repulsive. Everything we know at long range is attractive. To try to make a repulsive force at a long range is very difficult. I can put two north poles of a magnet together and I'll get repulsion over a very short distance. I can put two positive charges together and I'll get repulsion over a very short distance. But when it comes to billions of light years, no way. Attraction, yes. Repulsion, no. Therefore, I'm convinced that the material out there that is accelerating away from us, I say is accelerating toward the mass concentrations that are beyond our point of view, our observable universe. We're getting a little bit of hint of that material out there, that lumpiness, by way of the slight lumpiness we see in the Planck picture, so to speak. I don't think I've read those words anywhere yet. As you can tell, it's a speculation of mine, Lou. And it would be interesting to find out if that speculation eventually gets adopted as a possible theory of operation. NY2H, KQRIW in the TechNet.
NY2H. Well, the multiverse theory, I've heard it described as bubbles. Each Big Bang is the origin of a new bubble. And some of these bubbles can actually collide or merge. But I think each bubble is its own space-time, so I'm not really up on this. As far as, I don't read the NASA website that much. What I do is I read the general news, but generally, scientific news will be included, and there'll be certain things that rise to the top, and then I go to various sites that talk about them. And the other thing that I had mentioned earlier when I was in the car, let me let drop. And again, this is philosophical in nature, but Elon Musk, I think it was recently, probably within the last week, he was at a conference, and he said that the chance of us not being in a simulation was probably one out of billions. So, he feels we're in a simulation. Now, with the 10 minutes remaining for the TechNet, I doubt that we're going to come to any conclusion either way, or does it matter? But he sincerely believes this. Just wondering
in a simulation. Does that mean you and I are not really here, Paul? We're just a few electrons moving around in an integrated circuit chip inside of somebody's computer that is emulating or simulating this local universe? Is that what he's saying? That we're not really here? We're just a simulation and we think we're here? Over to you, Lou.
Yeah, I think that's where I am. Well, more or less, yeah. In other words, it could be a computer. And we're probably many times removed. In other words, there's a prime reality. So that's why he's saying the odds are much against us being the prime reality. And that civilization advanced to the point where they're intelligent enough to make these simulations. But of course, you have to jump another gap, that a simulation and the characters within the simulation, let's say, have to have a consciousness, right? So where does that consciousness come from? Again, it's something that came out, and you know, you can Google it and read about it and see what his comments are, and they're based on some other scientists' comments. But that's his belief, and the nature of it. Well, you know, yeah, that would imply not only us but everything around us. So we're talking about the expansion of the universe. I guess we can go into the simulator and change a constant, and do whatever we want. You know, it's very strange, and. But that's, if you ask them, and somebody did ask him, and this is what he said. So there you go.
What does that mean? Like, we're in a matrix, and we're all in somebody's model, railroad model? Boy, that's a weird one.
Yeah, you got it, John. That's exactly what it means. I mean, I can Google his name and that, and I'll give you a must simulation. Hold on one sec.
Yeah, love to read it.
Yeah, I've got another take on this. And that is, nothing in the universe is random. Everything that we don't have enough knowledge about looks random. When I flip a coin, I'm not taking a careful measurement of how much velocity and how much spin I give that coin.
Repeater, time out.
Not enough spin or velocity has been measured, therefore, whether it ends up heads or tails is, to me, random. If I took enough, if I measure enough knowledge of exactly how I measure, how I launch that coin, the way it's going to land is preordained. So, nothing is random if you have enough knowledge. So, if these other guys out there with a supercomputer at some other race, on some other planet, or on some other star, has enough knowledge of what exists on planet Earth, he can therefore do a simulation, emulation, and predict exactly what you and I are going to do in the future. So there's nothing random if you have enough knowledge. And maybe they have enough knowledge. Is that possibly what he's saying, Paul? I doubt it, but that's one possible interpretation. So they have modeled what we're going to do, but that's not what we are doing, so to speak. And Y2H, K2RW.
Well, I guess it's a free will, and they talk about that in some of the articles, too. But it's more than that. I mean, here's just one article of many that... computer-based virtual reality makes the idea that we could be living in a simulation more than just an abstract possibility. Some very smart people even think that this is not only possible, but likely, very likely. Many of them take their lead from Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom. He had a paper in 2003 in Philosophical Quarterly talking about this, but Musk jumped on board. Musk himself provides a neat example of the strange power of the theory to change everything and nothing. They talk about he's also afraid of artificial intelligence. Says even more, even more mind-spinning is that if Musk is right, then we're actually about to see AI being produced within AI. There could be no end to these worlds within worlds. So yeah, it gets, you know, going down the rabbit hole. I just threw it out there. If anybody's interested, they could research it. But the man is saying that it's a very, very, very sense that we're the, I forgot what the term was, something like prime reality or something like that, meaning that we're down in the food chain as far as being inside of these matrices, as John said. Yeah, that's what he's saying. So he's saying we're getting to Mars by, what, 2025, and we're also in a simulation.
I was on a Novichok one time, WS2N. Some physicist came up with that theory. He must have watched the same show. Elon Musk must have watched the same show I watched.
Is Elon Musk recommending that we do something different with this knowledge that we're in a simulation? Or, because he has got so much faith in that simulation, because this idea popped into his head, that he can create any piece of space hardware or electric vehicles that he wants, that he's positive he can put a man on Mars, he's positive he can launch his booster vehicles and bring them back and land them on the Earth and reuse them. So if the idea pops into his head, it's part of the simulation, all he's got to do is go do it. Is that sort of what he's saying, Lou? XY2H, K2IW?
Have a question when you get a chance.
Yeah, okay. I'm not, you know, it's interesting. Maybe that, you know, gives them a little optimism. Just a brief review. Elon Musk, the billionaire entrepreneur, this is a Dateline June 3rd, and founder of SpaceX, Tesla, and PayPal, has told an interviewer there is only a, quote, 1 in billions chance that we're not living in a computer simulation. Go ahead, John.
TC2WTV. Real quick, Dick, I just have a little slight disagreement with your viewpoint. I don't think that the way you're looking at things predictable by having knowledge works. Yes, in the coin flip, absolutely. Whether it's done by a human or a machine, yes, I think you're absolutely right there. But when you're dealing with the human, from my experience, it's not like machines. You can predict a machine, even failures. Everything is predictable. But we have insanity in the human. How do we account for that? You know, A plus B should be Z, but in this one guy, he's going to say it's Q, and there's no adjustments for that. And when you look at the permutations of that disaster, I don't think it's predictable. What do you have to say? KC2WGB.
There's a degree of yes or no on this one, as I see it, John. In the case of the coin, it has a given number of grams of weight, given number of units of moment of inertia. You launch it with a certain velocity, a certain spin, you can predict with very high accuracy the way it's going to land. Okay? That's a simple system. A human being has got, I don't know the exact number, 10 to the 14 cells, probably 10 to the 17 molecules. So 10 to the 14 cells have each got a huge amount of DNA, the amount of raw material required to really understand a human being would fill up every recording device we've got on planet Earth. So we don't have anywhere near the amount of knowledge to predict what a human being is going to do. So, yes, for all practical purposes, to you and I making a measurement, a human being appears to be extremely random. We know he's not, but we don't have enough knowledge at the cellular level, at the molecular level, to make a prediction on that too complicated system. That's what I think is going on there, John. KC2WGB, K2IW.
Okay, yeah, that's one way to look at it. Maybe if we had the necessary equipment to be able to analyze in reality everything, then you might be right. But when it, I worry about the insanity and the flippantness of somebody's thinking. Even when they read something as simple as, we were discussing the other night, poetry. Do people read the same poem, come up with different things? Do you think we could find the reason that happens? Possibly. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
You must be referring to Donald Trump. Because of some huge number of cells,